Could you talk a little bit more about how you actually got him to come down to the labs and how the relationship developed?
Yeah, it was probably too smart. Smart knew that he was going to come here, and that he was badly threatened, he felt, by, he was director at that point of the Carter-Durham Institute, the ranking scientific research center in Europe, in all of Europe. And accordingly, the Nazis knew who he was, and they said, well, we'll make you a permanent and heroic member of this whole German science enterprise, but you have to join our cause. Not necessarily perhaps become a Nazi as such, but become sympathetic to the Nazi principles. And very high level people in the Hitler government went after him. At that point, he began to buy his tickets for overseas. He was probably in a worse situation than the people who were driven out, you see. I mean, he was driven in, so to speak. He said, well, we want you and we'll make you a great hero. So, Beta and some others had already found that Cornell was a very friendly environment, and we heard this might that, and also through Darrow, you know about Darrow. Well, let us know about Darrow. A physicist who was the world's most expressive writer of modern physics, wrote books all about laboratories, his whole career was here, and introduced the world of learning to quantum physics and to much of the other. He was a expressor, a transfer agent, unparalleled. And someday I'll tell you all a lot more about Darrow. And you'll find your archives have got lots of Darrow in them. And he was a cosmopolitan physicist who paid great deal of attention to Europe and realized that it was the source then of the kind of frontier that we wanted to go in for. Darrow, perfectly fascinating character, regarded New Jersey and Summit, where we were doing a lot of this work, and Murray Hill when it was formed, as in the wilderness, barely past the occupation of the Indians and the savages, and a place that he visited only with great caution. He regarded New York and Chicago as probably the only civilized places west of London, Paris, and so on. And he carried this out with great style, great effectiveness. He announced that he would go to Chicago very willingly, talk to DeMar or anybody else who happened to be there, because he could go by train and get sleep and have breakfast and all that sort of thing. Whereas to come out to Murray Hill, he had to go by Antediluvian rail route. Anyway, he knew all about Dubai, and Dubai knew all about him, and they were very friendly, and Dubai was much welcomed by the whole physics and chemistry community in this country, and Darrow was an important part of that. So we used those mechanisms and then set up his link here.
Did he come down to Cornell once a month?
He came to Cornell very regularly. He liked to come to New York. He had other lots of other friends there. And of course, it wasn't too long. It was hard to get down to Cornell, but Dubai was accustomed to the rigors of the climate there, because as he grew up in Holland, as he often told me, he had to break the ice in his morning basin for washing his face and so on. So he wasn't aware.
Right at home in Ithaca.
Yeah, didn't bother him that much. But he did come down very often. He often came to West Street, and then he did come occasionally to Summit, which, and then of course came Murray Hill all the time, and came Murray Hill not many years before he died. Great reunion with him here. So it was a very long linkage.
Well, we'll get back to Dubai and his role in the synthetic rubber project in a few minutes, but I'd just like to round up a couple of loose ends, or to tie up some loose ends in this early period before you began to work on synthetic rubber. One was that you started off working at the Summit Lab, but it was in mid to late 41 that Murray Hill opened up, wasn't it? And
right.
When did you begin moving over here? When was, which of this work that we just discussed was still done at Summit?
Yeah, we were among the first occupants of Murray Hill, and came in, indeed, I think by Christmas of 41. We had to put together some of the walls. We were very proud of the laboratories being demountable and reassembled, you see, and we did some of it ourselves. And the chemical laboratory was one of the first to be occupied.
So most of the work on the Jaeger that we were just discussing would have been done here.
The very first and some of the very definitive project was to the summit. I guess we didn't publish it until 41.
I was just going by when you began to. That's true. It was when you began to discuss it at ACS meetings and
we started before then, you see, some very important parts of it were done some of it was published. It was discussed in 1940, and so we had done it in some instances. I remember the Detroit meeting of the American Chemical Society was one place where we began to put down our hair on the fact that you could really treat polymers as manageable, understandable, semi-crystalline solids.
There's two other questions I wanted to ask you about it. One is that, well, here we have a patent that arose out of this whole program of research on the surface hardening of linear polyamide bodies, and this is one of the, as we were saying before, that some theoretical insights into the structure of these polymers led to very practical uses. I'd like to just ask you how, what kind of practical use this particular patent got and some of the other early patents.
Yes, the intention of this one was for wire and cable sheathing, where you have on the one hand a very heavy abrasion of the surface because of the way things have to be installed and handled, you see. The cities of the U.S. at that point were being wired and cabled by pulling these two ducts, which is very tough mechanically. So we wanted the surfaces to be extremely hard and abrasion resistant. On the other hand, these things are also bent, and these polymers are relatively high modulus, would tend to be brittle, except that if you quenched, as we described in there, and stabilize the amorphous parts, you'd have a very much lower modulus and a very much higher flexibility. The elongation at break, particularly with the biaxial stress that you get from bending, was perhaps 4 or 5 times what you got on the from the crystallized part. So you produce in one extrusion, one coating of the system, a range of mechanics which had been only dreamt of before. Now, this had subsequently many other, this reason we did was that one, it has many other applications. As you know, the whole domain of hardware, of catches, of locks, of bearings for small machinery, made of polyamides now, made of nylons. And they use, they being a whole range of fabricators, not just DuPont, but there are hundreds of them now, they use techniques like this to make the maximal wear resistance and lubricating properties of the surface and still maintain these toughnesses and high elongations of the bulk of the bearing or of the mechanical part.
The other question that occurred to me when you mentioned the Detroit meeting of the ACS and beginning to describe this work in a broader arena, what kind of reactions did you get from chemists elsewhere?
Well, they were rather startled because, on the one hand, you see, there had been very little discussion of these systems by their originators, by the original synthesizer, which is DuPont.
Mm-hmm.
The British had done it not as early, but the British, as we'll come to a connection, were very curious about polyesters, but they had not reported anything either. And this is a fascinating era of chemistry, Jeff, and it's very close to the excellent things that you are creating in chalk, namely the basic science activity in this field was heavily constrained by the perfectly logical and enduring traditions of the originating company. They patented, and those patents were complicated and empirical, and they didn't have a lot of scope, but they were sure enough covering that composition of matter, and nobody else did anything about it. They did some studies, and they did some very clever work at DuPont. You're probably getting some of this from them. Julian Hill, for example. Mm-hmm. We were talking to him. He's very ancient now. He's even more ancient than I am. One of the great ornithologists, amateur ornithologists in the country, discovered how you could get nylon fibers. He did the first pulling of fibers. Carruthers didn't know this. Can do this. And Hill and the people that he worked with them were in bitterly and on almost in a frenzy trying to find ways to commercialize, to make the stuff come out as a good piece of nylon, a good fiber of nylon. They didn't discuss this with any university people. They informed Roger Adams and Speed Marvel, who were interested, and Adams had a fellow named Lycan as a graduate student who had been examining the hull, which is kind of flexible and rubbery and interesting, of a catbrier berry. The catbrier is the worst you ever get encountered briars, they're green briars that you reach out and grab you around here. These things don't have little berries, which birds are interested in. Roger Adams, who was a great chemist at Illinois, was curious about the hull of these things. What did Lycan and Adams find? It was a polyester. They didn't know what kind of a polyester, you see, but, and so they were vague. Adams was pretty interested when Carruthers began to synthesize these things. But there's a long answer to your question, that there just was a sort of excitement and surprise in the chemical community when we began to talk about polyanders and polyesters as unique structures of matter and having extraordinary physical properties.
Did you find that most of the interest came from people at DuPont and other industrial companies, or were the academic chemists really beginning to sit up and take notice?
DuPont were the most interested in starting because it was their thing, and they had done it, you see. I mean, they'd synthesized it, and they had, in fact, they had all these properties that led their chemical director to say to Williams, when we finished some of this Detroit thing, well, you know more about it than we do. He said that about Marlon. Other chemists began to get interested, pretty slow. Fleury, of course, was keenly aware of all the possibilities. He knew what DuPont had done. He was there at the time. He had published absolutely superb papers on the kinetics of esterification and the kind of states that you had kinetically in order to get the high molecular weight. He had not followed the physical properties and the structural aspects at that point.
Well, we'll go back to Fleury as well, since he was involved in the synthetic rubber project also. One last question I wanted to ask you before we leave the period before synthetic rubber was, around the same time that the labs moved to Mary Kira, you also had an interesting event in your life. You got married in November of 1941, I wondered if you'd just tell us a little bit about your wife and what her background was.
The person who is just as she was then, and sympathetic to science and research and the internal demands of trying to make science and industry and technology and communications all go together.
Had she had a scientific background? Most of them is move on to synthetic rubbers, which by the end of 1942, we know something of the background of the national project. The Baruch Committee report in the summer of 1942 and the increasing urgency of gearing up for production of DRS rubber. By the end of 1942, one begins to find in the case files in the archives that Bell is spending more and more time and effort thinking about some of the problems. And I wondered if you'd tell us the background of how Bell got involved in this project.
The background was from the same issue that we described earlier, that being a major user, probably again the major user, of carefully chemically controlled rubber. Cable sheathing primarily, but all sorts of wire covering, drop wires, and so on. This had gone on for some years, based, of course, primarily on natural rubber. The invention of continuous vulcanization had come from the labs and was dominating the field, but licensed to other people. It was a high-speed vulcanization. You see, tires, of course, they didn't care because they had to mold the tire and they had time to let it be vulcanized. This is what makes rubber tough, and it's the use of sulfur and so on. And so what our people did was to discover a method of vulcanizing during extrusion, which meant you had seconds or perhaps even tenths of seconds or hundredths of seconds in order to carry out the whole reaction and get it done. This was quite revolutionary, and it attracted a lot of attention. Now, in order to keep up with that and in the traditions of the Bell laboratories that we mentioned earlier, a significant number of our staff that are shown on your chart there participated in the rubber technology and chemistry community. They belong to the rubber chemistry section of ACS, which, as you know, is a rather special one. They formed a community of their own and are autonomous compared to the ACS. So that had gone along. Now, Williams was a chemical director and had himself been interested in the purification of a form of rubber, gutta percha, which was semi-crystalline. And Storks, following the techniques of Davison and Germer, had shown the molecular configuration of this stuff. Some of the Europeans had shown that it was a trans chain. So here was an early example of what we carried forward in the synthetic polyester and polyamide case of people understanding the detailed molecular configuration of the things we used as insulators and structural materials in telephony. Okay, when Williams was a very scientifically minded person, and as a personal interest which was supported and welcomed by the Bell Laboratories, but not involved in the commercial mission of the Bell Laboratories, was his identification of vitamin B1 and his eventual synthesis of it. So he was known for scientific skills, and this was a heroic part of the era of organic synthesis and organic chemistry. And therefore, when the Baruch report came around, and others in Washington, Jeffers, who'd been president of the chairman of the Union Pacific Railroad, and was brought in to form the Rubber Reserve to contain and conserve what rubber we had and try to make synthetic go as well. When those fellows got together, they saw that our scientific and technical base was really pretty feeble. At that time, the national strategy had decreed, however, that we would nationalize the industry. War was getting tougher and tougher, and we would make use of all the patents they had of German work, which was supposed to have been successful. The Germans were supposed to have had synthetic rubber, which was a frightening hypothesis, if true, because we didn't, and the Japanese and Germans had cut off the Far East, and the war would hang in the balance. You wouldn't have mechanized warfare, you couldn't have aircraft, you couldn't have a lot of other things without rubber. And our domestic economy would have collapsed as well. So, it was very wisely decided, and Bush already had a considerable hand in this, Vannevar Bush, and it was discussed with the President, that there would be a science and technology program, an R&D program for rubber. And instead of turning to the rubber industry, which was a logical thing to do, or the chemical industry, or the Standard Oil Company, Standard Oil of New Jersey, SO, had many of the German patents. In addition to that, they had some very good work by Thomas and Sparks, two of their people, in the modification of the German patents on polyacetylene to make butyl rubber out of it, to feed the cross-linkage. But instead of turning to any of those people, they turned to a place that they thought Bush and the President and Jeffers and others had a stronger scientific background, but had the sense of use, the sense of practicality, which is the Bell Laboratories. And Williams, Buckley was consulted on this. Buckley was the one who made the final decision to do it, and he persuaded Williams to become the principal scientific advisor to the Rubber Reserve Corporation and to Jeffers, who was really the rubber czar. So off we went on that. Fuller was quickly recruited by Williams to help with the organization nationally. We were assigned, I was assigned to do much of the basic scientific planning, but also the work that we thought would apply to the early control of the synthetic rubber which was going to be made, which was patterned after the German butadiene styrene. And in the Mayflower Hotel, I think now vanished, in Akron, in December of 1942, we sat around the table in a room a little smaller than this and nationalized the rubber industry, which was, I guess, the first American industry to be nationalized. The components, major components, of course, were U.S. rubber, Goodrich, Goodyear, Firestone, all concentrated in Akron, and the Standard Oil. There were a few, New Jersey, there were a few accessory outfits which did very well. Some of them made vulcanizing ingredients, some of them did other things. You need more details on this, we can produce it all. But from that point on, Williams and Fuller, Fuller was an invaluable element, recruited the what seemed to be the major industrial centers and the major university centers. Now, the idea of university centers was revolutionary in Washington. They didn't think that they could contribute anything, and we said, well, that's wrong. There are a few, not many, because the subject of polymers was a matter of active disinterest, if that's okay. But there was Marvel and some of his colleagues, Snyder and a couple others, Adam and I, along with Roger Adams. Roger Adams was then very heavily engaged in Pentagon kind of work and didn't get into this so much. But Marvel, of course, did become a very fundamental element in it. Then we said, there are going to be people that can be brought into this that have never heard of polymers, but they are so important in chemical control and in analysis, which we had built a strong center under Beverly Clark here in the Bell Laboratories, you see, which is really quite distinguished in the whole field of analytic chemistry. We said, that's got to be put in. They said, well, that's foolish. It'll take 20 years for those people to provide anything. Well, we said, that isn't so, and we recruited Pete Kozoff, who became an enthusiastic, just I am Kozoff in Minnesota, a man from Germany originally. He became an absolutely invaluable element, you see, and produced thousands of carefully controlled specimens of synthetic rubber, quite outside what the American industry has been able to do. We then got DeBuy, who was deeply devoted to the cause, but from his alien status was regarded as so hazardous that he had to be accompanied by a policeman or a military delegate at all the meetings in Akron. We had a lot of meetings in Akron, which we nationalized the industry, you see, and DeBuy couldn't even go into the meetings without this fellow sitting there. Now, of course, he had no idea what they assumed, I guess, was that DeBuy would blow up the whole city, or blow up the plant. They had no idea what DeBuy was talking about, but he took us all in good humor. Then I had a set of special liaisons with DeBuy in New York at the Barbizon Plaza Hotel, where we would not allow any of these policemen around, but he was not allowed to come into Bell Laboratories. DeBuy and I, and you have some of the duplicates of the original notes that he made at that point, which we recorded in the Centennial of American Chemical Society. I think you have some of those at any rate. DeBuy proceeded to invent and create the whole era of light scattering for macromolecular solutions, which now dominates much of the bioscience in the field, as well as being invaluable to our work in those synthetic rubber days. He was also very much into, this came from Einstein's original concept of scattering of light in liquids due to the fluctuations in density of the liquid, and then due to solids which you could put in the liquid. And DeBuy remembered that work, which was way back in the 20s and even before, and remembered that Einstein had proposed a perfectly wonderful correspondence between osmotic pressure, which would always distribute the solid uniformly through the solution, and thermal fluctuations, which would make it non-uniform, you see. Mm-hmm. And there would have to be a balance there. And this is really one of the elegant theoretic developments of the century. And DeBuy then did this in the rooms and many meetings we had in the Barbizon Plaza Hotel. Some of it was on the back of envelopes, but it was in all the paper, too. And experiments were begun, partly at his laboratory at Cornell, with Beakey and McCartney, and Beakey was a fellow who later became head of the General Electric Laboratories. And that part took off. The other programs, MIT was involved, a couple of people from Harvard had parts in it, Tobolsky and his associates from Princeton came in, did elegant work. You've seen, I can develop this as much as you want, but I don't want to bore you to death, but this is the way the synthetic weather game got started.
Well, that's a very helpful introduction. Let me go back to some of the documents you have and also ask you some more specific questions about it. You said that there was that meeting at the Mayflower Hotel in Akron in December of 42, and here we have what I think is just a fascinating document that you wrote, December 7th, the anniversary of Pearl Harbor, on the scientific problems that, from a physical organic standpoint, that synthetic weather posed. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the background of that memo. Was this in preparation for that meeting? Or?
Yes. We were seeing, of course, that the whole fate of the war was beginning to hang on the synthetic weather supplies. They just simply determined whether we had armament or whether we didn't. And so we thought that the studies we had begun on the solid state and properties of polymers relating their chemical composition and structure to their mechanics, which of course is the issue in the wartime usage. These tires and other things have to have special hysteresis qualities and other properties. We thought that earlier kind of philosophy or strategy could be applied to synthetic rubber. We were also very much concerned about the compositional control because we knew, I guess it's discussed, I've looked at this for 45 years or whatever it is, but I guess that, 43, that the compositional control would be fundamental in how the aromatic links were distributed in essentially aliphatic or olefinic and aliphatic environments, you see, and we knew that this would make quite a difference. The polarizability of those benzene residues was really quite vital, and you could get failures. Let me put in a footnote, we didn't know then, but the Soviet-German campaign was essentially decided, the historians say, by the fact that the armored columns from Germany were unable to move and to perform because the tank treads embrittled in the Russian winter. And that crucial time, and you remember they struck almost toward Moscow as they were in the northern zone, if memory will have to be from reading some good books, but I remember it. The Soviet columns, the Soviets had no columns, but their defenders, were able to stop those armored penetrations because the armor simply failed. It could not move effectively. The embrittlement disabled the tanks. Anyway, the reason was apparently